silence is command.
Please be seated. I apologize on behalf of the court that we are several moments late for this afternoon hearing, but I caused the delay by being at a judicial education committee. The case for this afternoon is 07AP1083D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Alan D. Eisenberg. Representing Mr. Eisenberg is Attorney Richard J. Cale. He will have a 20-minute time period to address the court. Mr. Eisenberg will have 5 minutes. We will then hear from Paul Schlossenbart, who was representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation for 30 minutes. Mr. Cale, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cale.
We're here on appeal from a report of referee Richard Miniman in his lawyer disciplinary case. It is based, his report recommends the finding of a violation, one violation of 20:3.1a, frivolousness, and it arises out of this fact scenario in early, and if I may, the finding of frivolousness in this case is unsupported, and it's the product of anger and not principle. And the recommendation with respect to sanction is just crazy. And so out of keeping with the precedent and the record in this case and even the request of the OLR as to be inappropriate. It stems from this set of facts. Early 2001, Mr. Eisenberg's hired by a man who we refer to throughout the pleadings here, William, in connection with disputes with his wife. They're going through a divorce, and Mr. Eisenberg's asked to help with the divorce. She has accused him of battery, and felony charges are pending against him, and Mr. Eisenberg's asked to defend that. And William asks Mr. Eisenberg to bring civil claims against his wife for the falsehoods that are that she promulgates in connection with the criminal charges. Mr. Eisenberg tries the criminal case to a jury, And before Judge Koshnick in Jefferson County, and there is an acquittal. Mr. Eisenberg's client says that his wife has lied in bringing these charges, and Mr. Eisenberg believes, having tried the case and having won the acquittal, that in fact she did lie. Shortly thereafter, he institutes a lawsuit against her for defamation, abuse of process, malicious prosecution. And it is that pleading and the initiation of that case which is said to violate 20:3.1a. That's a finding that I would submit would not be made against any lawyer in this state except Alan Eisenberg. And if you look at the reasoning behind both the underlying civil findings and the findings of the referee in this case, you'll find not only is there not a basis, and of course the distinction between the civil findings of frivolousness, which went up on appeal and ultimately cost Mr. Eisenberg well in excess of $150,000 in costs paid, not including the costs that he endured in his own time and the fees that he paid to his lawyer in the civil cases and to me, those findings are not supported. And if you look at the findings of Judge Graham and the Court of Appeals in that case, they are based on things such as the fact that the defendant, Margaret, filed a financial statement in the divorce case claiming she had no assets, which it was reasoned. If there were no assets, then there was no legitimate basis for bringing that lawsuit except to harass, as if money is the only legitimate basis for bringing a defamation case. I submit to you that it is very often the case that when one is seeking to vindicate and declare one's good name, and that was so in this case. The record's uncontradicted that's what William asked Mr. Eisenberg to do. In the discipline disciplinary case, as the court knows, there's a requirement that not only that all the elements of the civil statute be met, but that they be met by clear and satisfactory and convincing evidence, the middle standard, and that there be a showing of subjective intent on the part of the lawyer against whom discipline is sought. There isn't any evidence in this record that would support that. Mr. Eisenberg had, and in many of the instances where discipline is imposed for a client for institution of frivolous claims, there is some relationship between the lawyer and the party against whom the claims are being made that show a motive, that show some vendetta or some financial purpose. Mr. Eisenberg didn't ever see this woman who he sued until the criminal trial, until he cross-examined her in the criminal trial. Another of the bases for the finding of frivolousness was that witnesses named by Mr. Eisenberg's associate in connection with the civil suit wouldn't testify when deposed that they had had a diminution of their regard for William on account of the publicity associated with the felony battery charges. That, it was reasoned, also showed there were no damages, and therefore the case must have been brought for no reason other than to maliciously injure Margaret. And of course, one didn't know all that they would testify to on the basis of their depositions. And once again, there's sound law that says that damage may be presumed when the false statements are claims of criminal conduct, which these were. Another of the bases for the contention or the finding that there was frivolousness was that the lawsuit was started too fast and that Mr. Eisenberg didn't properly investigate, forgetting, of course, that he knew the case well enough to successfully try a criminal jury trial to a successful verdict on the very same set of facts that he was alleging in his complaint. It's an odd and ironic circumstance. The OLR instituted two charges against Mr. Eisenberg. One was that the initiation of the lawsuit was frivolous, and secondly, that in bringing a pro se motion at the conclusion of the appellate process, objecting or inquiring concerning the allocation of the costs, he was acting frivolously. And the irony is that charge was dismissed by the referee, or recommended for dismissal by the referee. That charge was won under a statute that says in representing a client, a lawyer may not assert a position for no purpose other than to delay and so on.
Why isn't this the situation that Mr. Eisenberg has had an extensive disciplinary past? We generally, or often, have progressive discipline. Why shouldn't we look at this as though it is the straw that broke the camel's back, and ergo revocation?
For a couple of reasons. Number one, there's no disciplinable offense here. And in fact, I think that his disciplinary history and the reputation that he has is more the reason for the institution of the frivolous claims in the civil case and the institution of this prosecution than the facts of this case. Any lawyer in this room who brought a defamation case under these facts, even if they lost, would not be the victim of $150,000 of costs. And here's an example of the treatment Mr. Eisenberg received in the course of this case. While he was representing William, and this case was instituted on William's say-so and what William described as the facts, the cost were presumed to be borne and to be the responsibility of Mr. Eisenberg. Immediately thereafter, Mr. Eisenberg had counsel, and he was no longer the lawyer, he was the client. And in the proceedings thereafter, costs were also imposed, and the presumption was not, once again, that the lawyer associated with the bringing of the briefs and the filing of the appeals and so on was presumed to be responsible, but no, Mr. Eisenberger can't. So whether as lawyer or as client, he's the one with the bullseye on his back. And it's the disciplinary history, I think, that bears on that. The another of the reasons why Judge Graham said that there was frivolousness was that Mr. Eisenberg was alleged to have requested but then not attended a mediation session. And there were sanctions imposed as a result of that. And perhaps one is subject to sanctions for that sort of a circumstance. But that's not the basis for showing that the initiation of the lawsuit was infirm in the first instance. That's just peevishness. And the lawsuit was dismissed, you know, in part because Margaret was a fragile appearing person who cried. But being a sympathetic litigant does not make for frivolousness. As long as if we separate, you know, principles from personalities, those things don't bear on the question of whether the suit was initiated in good faith. There wasn't even an objective showing of frivolousness in this case, and there wasn't a shred of evidence to suggest that Mr. Eisenberg didn't believe in good faith that he had a good case. He testified to that effect. He'll ask two questions to that effect. And there was no showing to the contrary. In the Lauer case, you know, the court made clear that the OLR's burden is not just to show that the charges brought or the claims made by the lawyer lacked merit by an objective standard, but that they have the burden of showing subjective intent. And there isn't a shred of evidence to suggest a motive or a purpose other than, you know, a good faith effort to do the work of his client. William, in this case, was you know, made the newspapers in his small community as an alleged wife batterer. Then this was a serious wrong that had been done him by a person who wasn't truthful.
Mr. Cale, I'd like to follow up a little bit on the question that Justice Bradley asked, but I want to come at it just a little bit differently. It's my understanding that the last time we had a discipline case involving Mr. Eisenberg, it arose in approximately 2004, about 5 years ago. At that time, the referee, who was a former circuit judge, Tim Volke, recommended that we revoke Mr. Eisenberg's license to practice law. As you're well aware, court did not do that. We suspended him instead. Now we have Richard Nineman, who is the referee, very different background and experience than Mr. Volke, but certainly an excellent reputation as a lawyer. His recommendation is revocation of Mr. Eisenberg's license to practice law. When we have two recommendations from respected people, respected as referees, respected as attorneys, both telling us we should revoke his license. Admittedly, different situations, different years, but why shouldn't we pay some heavy, heavy heed to what has been recommended to this court?
Thank you, Justice. Justice Lee, you certainly, these are well-respected people, and they provide a valuable service, and they are skillful and respected lawyers. But this is not a popularity contest. Both of those decisions, both of these reports are the product of anger. But being angry, and perhaps even being responsible, even if Mr. Eisenberg was culpable in some fashion for generating the anger that underlies both of those decisions, that still doesn't warrant an honorable finding that there was frivolousness associated with his work on behalf of William. The 814.025 is its successor, and the disciplinary rules, they're not intended to be punishment for people who make us angry, you know, who maybe there sometime thereafter, you know, behave in a way that we don't like. There are sanctions associated with each of the things that might transpire in the course of a proceeding. There's contempt, if there are sanctions that I believe in the case of the missed mediation, there could have been a sanction. In Referee Nineman's report, he suggests that Mr. Eisenberg's conduct in the course of this disciplinary case itself might warrant discipline. Well, maybe it does, and if so, the OLR could bring charges. But I don't think that you could bootstrap them back and say, gee, maybe now, because I'm so angry at the way things have been conducted in this case, I'm going to find frivolousness with respect to the charges made against Margaret. This is an adversary system, and somebody's wrong in most every case. And, you know, if I got up here and I said, it's Thursday, 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 to each one of you, emphatically, you'd say, no, it's not. But no one would claim that I misrepresented something to you deliberately. And we shouldn't in this case. Another of the reasons why you shouldn't take this conduct preceded the last disciplinary action. Mr. Eisenberg can't be thought to have been forewarned with respect to this conduct by the discipline most recently imposed. Which is not to say, you know, that there isn't some cumulative effect of discipline, but in both of these instances, this is the product of intemperance. The OLR brought two charges, and at the beginning of, in their pleadings, they asked for a 6-month suspension. They have a very measured sensibility about what's appropriate discipline in this case, and they tried the case in its entirety, notwithstanding that they had one of the two charges dismissed. They asked for a 6-month suspension. Taking everything into account, including the disciplinary history. And really, that wasn't the product of some graciousness on the part of the OLR. That was the exercise of a seasoned prosecutorial staff with respect to disciplinary charges. So these charges, in my opinion, were not at all sustained. But even if they were, number one, there wasn't a showing of subjective intent. Number two, the elements were not established by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. And lastly, the discipline is just so out of keeping with what was even requested by the OLR as to I think really reflect the underlying anger that is the product of, that infects the whole process. Mr. Eisenberg was driven to the brink of bankruptcy by this case. And is he a tenacious litigator? I mean, did he carry this forward after having suffered the original finding? Yes. Right. He didn't think that it was frivolous. And he'll tell you so himself. But this is not a disciplinary offense. Am I treading on my colleague's time?
Your timing was set for 20 minutes. Is that right, yes. Mr. Pond? So when your red light goes on, you will go off. Mr. Eisenberg may appear, and you will have 5 minutes thereafter for rebuttal counsel.
Is your argument in effect that not that there's nothing in the conduct of this matter that might have warranted a charge, but that the charge made is simply the wrong charge or not a founded charge?
No. I think that there was no basis for any charges here. But what the OLR does in its briefing is talk to you about offensive personality, you know, which wasn't charged. And it may be if they thought that these factors that are said to support the assertion of frivolousness, if they're valid, then they would have been valid with respect to a different set of charges. I mean, I wouldn't want to promote or endorse the bringing of charges of those of that type. But isn't that really, if you think about what Judge Graham did in the original set of findings that the OLR makes use of, that's what he's doing. Saying you didn't show up at this mediation. And therefore, I'm going to find that this whole course of conduct was frivolous. Well, and incidentally, what the OLR has alleged is that the bringing of this lawsuit from its inception was frivolous. And the conduct thereafter does not bear on that analysis. The There's something made of the fact that there's an allegation that Mr. Eisenberg made a statement to opposing counsel that the lawsuit was initiated to gain leverage in the divorce case. And that that's somehow an that shows an improper motive in instituting the charges. Well, really, even if Mr. Eisenberg denies that, incidentally, but even if it were true, gaining leverage it doesn't reflect frivolousness. I mean, the question is not was it instituted to gain leverage, either monetarily or otherwise, but was the leverage that was generated based on legitimate claims that were valid and had merit? The OLR doesn't, and incidentally, in this case, the OLR has made much of a claim that we conducted ourselves in trying to relitigate the civil case. And of course, we agreed we wouldn't. And they assert, and correctly so, that the Lauer and the Wydule cases stand for the principle that one may not do that in this context. And we've done nothing of the kind. In both Lauer and Wydule, those litigants asked that the court, in a disciplinary case, undo the sanctions that had been imposed upon them under 814.025. Mr. Eisenberg has paid, and I think it's well in excess of $150,000, and has not asked anyone to undo that. So we're not attempting to relitigate the case. That doesn't mean that the OLR is not obliged to establish each of the elements of the frivolousness rule by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. That's not done just by reference to the civil findings.
Mr. Kale, your red light is on. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Eisenberg, you have 5 minutes.
Justices, may it please the court. Well, the last time I was here was in the early 90s. It was 91. The case was City of Racine versus Rabideau. This court billed it as the case of the month. And here I was after spending $25,000 of my own money pursuing an appeal for a $50 dog. And it was a matter of principle, and I came to this court, and this court reversed the lower courts. The case was billed as case of the month. It was in the chambers across the street. Hundreds of people attended. And here I am back here 9 years later, and I'm not even case of the month, and I'm not even the dog. I'm not doing well. It looks like I've become the Rodney Dangerfield of the legal profession. If this is the funeral of my law practice, then this must be my swan song or my premature eulogy. When I was hired to defend Bill Deutsch, and this is all on the record, I accepted a written contract with him that I would defend him on the criminal case, and I would, if victorious, I would bring a civil suit to try to help him recoup his good name and his legal fees. I did not know the woman. You can't do depositions in a criminal case. I saw her for the first time for a couple of hours in the criminal trial. It was evident to me as I testified that she committed perjury, which was extremely disappointing, and it enraged Deutsch and his family, and they asked me to file the civil suit that I had promised to do in the first place. I still didn't know the woman. I would have been is attorney's fees. That's really all he wanted out of it. As I testified, he acquired an expensive stallion in divorce. She was working. She was not a pauper. And what he wanted was meager, and I thought reasonable. I had spent many months preparing for both the criminal and the civil case. The civil case didn't go well, and the tables were turned, and it then became an action against me and full employment for the attorney who brought the case. It wasn't $150,000, it wasn't $155,000, it wasn't $160,000, it was way over $165,000 without another $150,000 out of my pocket for attorney's fees, not to mention enormous stress, which has taken an enormous toll on me. So $300,000 isn't enough of a sanction, is it? That's not a sanction. That's irrelevant. And now this. $29,000 in an OLR bill before today, not including what additional bill comes after today. That's not a sanction. The recommendation, despite the comments of Justice Bradley and the implication of the comment from Justice Crook, OLR, the arm of this court, made a recommendation for a six-month suspension. That was their recommendation. It's my belief that they're still recommending a six-month suspension. For some reason, without reviewing the thousands of pages of record from the courts below and the referee, he claims that he reviewed everything, but it doesn't seem so from his decision. They don't square. It seems that I haven't gotten a fair shake. This hasn't been a level playing field, and I like fair treatment. I would like to go to my maker with my boots on. I'd like to finish out my days as a lawyer. I've helped thousands of people since 1966. I've paid my dues. I've earned my way. I fought for the oppressed, the suppressed, the depressed, and then just plain old pressed. I have fought for every kind of minority. Last year, I moved the admission of one of the first Hmong lawyers in the state. Same day, founded the Hmong law offices.
Mr. Reisenberg, what do you think is fair here?
What do I think is fair?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To be perfectly honest with you.
That's a good idea.
I am trying to be honest.
Pardon me?
I am trying to be honest.
Good.
If I was here representing anybody else, I'd be asking for this case to be thrown out against me or any other lawyer. For some reason, frivolous action suddenly means an ethical violation, as though it's automatic. The fact that I've been disciplined before, this claim is a straw that breaks the camel's back. I don't think it's any such thing. I don't think I've been treated fairly. When Judge Volke issued his decision, it was an intemperate rant, and this court did not abide by it. Mr. Ninneman's decision is the same caliber. It's an intemperate rant. He ranted against me because I subpoenaed the woman who had lied against Mr. Deutsch. Because I subpoenaed her, that's it. That caught me a rant. This is just not fair.
Now, just thrown out. You think it should be thrown out, this complaint
really
against
do.
You?
I really do.
On the grounds that, assuming that the finding or the holding in the civil case of frivolousness is correct. Even so, you don't think it's a grounds for violation of 20:3.1A3.
No, I mean, there are elements of that. Mr. Kay has pointed out OLR doesn't meet those elements. I didn't do anything here for financial gain or personal motive. But this was a lawsuit that I was filing. I can never get the $300,000 back. Now they want the rest of my license and my life.
This is your fifth charge, isn't it?
I've lost track. Maybe it's even more. I don't know. Well, to tell you the truth, it's not the fifth charge.
All right.
There have been. I'd like to answer. This is not the fifth charge. There have been probably hundreds that have been brought by them and then get thrown out. You know, I looked in the mirror last night when I had my clothes off getting ready for bed, and I was amazed Mr. Kayo was right. There is a target on my back. So the truth is, I am a target. It's what Mr. Keogh calls AES. It's the Alan Eisenberg syndrome. I think I've been a scapegoat for years.
You're a victim.
I think I've been a scapegoat. If there are 20 that get thrown out every year, then what's going on here? Yes, I think I've been victimized over the years. It's been going on since 1966. So it's been very hard on me, very, very hard. And to say there, and to sit there and act as though this is all meaningless to me, it's just not right. This has been very, very hard on me.
Court understands that it's always difficult for a lawyer who is subject to discipline and repeated discipline, and that we certainly understand that.
This is like attending my own funeral. It may be.
We understand that. Your red light is on. Does anyone have any questions?
I certainly don't want to be accused of running a red light.
There's no penalty for that. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwarzenbart, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. I have the honor of representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation as retained counsel in this matter. The argument I think the Court has heard today is somewhat unusual because there's been no reference at all to the fact that standards of review apply in this context. This is an appeal of an attorney disciplinary proceeding. It's governed by Supreme Court Rule 22.17(3). Standards of review applicable to civil appeals apply in this context. Mr. Eisenberg comes before the Court today challenging the findings of fact and conclusions of law drawn by referee Miniman that the OLR has proven by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that Mr. Eisenberg filed the Deutsch action and took other actions in that case where he knew or where it was obvious that such action would serve merely to harass or maliciously injure Margaret Klein. The standard of review is that the referee's findings of fact are affirmed unless they are clearly erroneous. Conclusions of law are reviewed on a de novo basis, as is the recommendation for discipline. This Court, in ordinary civil appeals and in appeals in disciplinary proceedings, defers to the referee as the finder of fact on matters based on the assessment of witness credibility. We've cited those cases in our brief. There's really been no discussion in the briefs or the argument today on behalf of Mr. Eisenberg as to the standards of review or what it means for findings to be clearly erroneous. I think the decisions of this court, as long as I've been in practice, since the court moved from the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence test to the clearly erroneous test, suggests that in order for findings to be clearly erroneous, it's not simply that the finder of fact could have drawn a different conclusion and the appellate court disagrees with what the finder of fact found. The evidence in support of a contrary finding itself has to constitute the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. Given those exacting standards of review, it comes as no surprise that there's been little attention given to them. And in effect, what we've had is an attempt to re-argue the case that was argued before referee Ninneman. And today we've heard words and phrases like anger, crazy, that...
Is OLR still requesting a six-month suspension, or what is OLR requesting today?
OLR is requesting at least a six-month suspension. And I believe we've addressed that in our brief. The basis for that, quite frankly, is the 6 months is the minimum period that triggers an obligation on the part of Mr. Eisenberg to come before this court after the expiration of whatever the suspension period would be in order to establish that he has the moral character required under the rules for reinstatement. And that's the basis for it.
Is it usual for the OLR to look at a frivolous action and then move that into discipline? There was a time where, if I remember my history correctly, that Bapper took the position, one frivolous, and that would fall within the code. And the court, in a case of, no, that's not it, that you have to have, maybe it could be one, but there has to be something else, something bigger and better, different. Is my recollection correct?
I believe you're correct, Justice Abramson, because... I got my law degree in December of 1981, and I believe we were exactly in that phase. The frivolous action statute had just been adopted, and I know in the time there was a concern in the profession that a finding of frivolousness could lead to discipline. I think the court answered those concerns in the Lauer case, where the court made clear, and this was under a different rule, that the wording was somewhat different, but I think the principles still apply.
In part because the judges were, and I can't remember, the Court of Appeals or Trial Court, was sending frivolous rulings to the BAPR as an automatic thing.
As an automatic referral. I believe I recall discussing that with Mr. Sternberg back in the days when he was the administrator of BAPR.
So then how do you justify this?
The justification for this, Your Honor, I think flows from the findings that were made in the civil action by the late Judge Graham, who was serving as the reserve judge on the sanctions motion brought against Mr. Eisenberg. There were very specific findings made in that case, and it's Exhibit 31 in this record. Judge Graham found that there was knowledge on the part of Mr. Eisenberg that the claim was frivolous and was brought merely to harass or maliciously injure Ms. Klein. There have been a couple of cases before this court where discipline has been imposed, one of them being the Waduli case, the other one being the Lauer case. I would suggest, Your Honor, that this case bears some similarity to the Waduli case. There's a lot of denial on the part of the respondent that he did anything wrong. There's blaming of the client. And I believe there is ample evidence in this record to support the referee's findings of fact that Mr. Eisenberg did in fact know and intentionally bring this action merely for the purpose of harassing or maliciously injuring Ms. Klein. The referee in this case set out his findings of fact in 16 detailed findings, none of which are specifically attacked.
Counsel, before you get to the findings, I want to also talk about the level of discipline. At the hearing before the referee, OLR sought a 6-month suspension.
Correct.
In the text of your brief, you ask for at least a 6-month suspension. And in the, what I used to call the prayer, but what we call the conclusion, you ask for discipline commensurate with the violations as necessary and appropriate for the protection of the public. What discipline should be imposed here?
What I said earlier today, at least a 6-month suspension.
Would he revoke?
The position that I spoke personally with Mr. Saleen yesterday, and this is an institutional decision by OLR. My instructions as retained counsel were at least a 6-month suspension, leaving that to the discretion of the court based upon its assessment of the discipline to be imposed in this case in light of the past disciplinary record.
So you're not here advocating revocation.
That's correct. Regarding the findings, ultimately what is being challenged in this case is a finding of fact of knowledge or intent, that is a fact issue, just as it is in, for example, a fraud case. The jury returns a verdict saying there was intent to deceive. That's a fact issue. It's reviewed on the basis of the clearly erroneous standard.
Counselor, I want to just interrupt you just a minute so that my mind is clear on this point. And I didn't go back and look, so I don't know the answer, although I could after we're done, but if you know it, that will help me. Did OLR, in the last disciplinary matter before us, request revocation, or did they request a suspension of a term specific?
Collection, and again, I'm retained counsel. I'm not there every day in the bowels of OLR,
sure.
But my recollection is a 1-year suspension.
What was requested. Okay, thank you very much.
Turning to the findings of fact by the referee. Finding number one, timing of the lawsuit. Less than 18 hours after the acquittal to the verdict, in the words of the referee, Mr. Eisenberg rushed to file the Deutsch action in order to have it available to serve at a previously scheduled pretrial conference. There's really no dispute about the operative facts there. The question becomes, is there some reasonable basis that the referee could take that fact and infer knowledge or intent on the part of Mr. Eisenberg to be using this lawsuit for the purpose of harassing or maliciously injuring Ms. Klein? I would suggest that there is such a basis for drawing that inference. There is evidence in this record about the effect that Mr. Eisenberg had on Ms. Klein when she testified in the criminal case. Judge Koshnick testified that the aggressive style to which Ms. Klein was subjected in the cross-examination in the criminal case had resulted in her breaking down on the stand and crying and suffering emotional trauma. Mr. Eisenberg, in the trial of the disciplinary case, characterized Ms. Klein as engaging in fakery when her emotional state was probably the same as it was in the criminal case. She was certainly crying and was visibly upset before the referee. The referee was the finder of fact. The referee found there was no fakery going on. Judge Koshnick testified on cross-examination from Mr. Eisenberg that notwithstanding whatever she may have said on the witness stand, he didn't believe that she ever admitted she lied to the police, and he believed the claim. There's concern raised, and it was raised on argument here, and I know the court is concerned with it. Should a finding of frivolousness in a civil case automatically lead to in the institution of a disciplinary action? Let me run another one past you. Does a criminal acquittal automatically lead to a witness in a criminal case being sued for defamation because of an acquittal? An acquittal is simply a not guilty of specific charges. It is not an exoneration. It's not a determination that a witness has made things up or that a witness has lied. It is simply nothing more than a jury concluding that the evidence presented in that case was insufficient to meet an even higher burden of proof, which is the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So what we had in this case was the day after an acquittal, which proves nothing in terms of whether or not the witness lied, is transformed into a lawsuit seeking damages for defamation, and frankly, it's one of the more poorly drafted complaints that I've seen. The court can review it. Exhibit 1, the specific words complained of were never pleaded. It, on its face, appears to be a document pleaded in haste. There was a conference scheduled before the family court commissioner the following day, and which leads to finding number 2. Because Mr. Eisenberg knew and believed it would harass and intimidate Margaret in order to obtain an advantage or leverage in the divorce action. In the 2 days prior to that pretrial conference, he had essentially beat up this woman on the witness stand and reduced her to tears. He knew he could intimidate her. What better way to do it than to file a lawsuit against her and serve it on her personally in the halls of the Jefferson County Courthouse? Finding number 3, Eisenberg failed to perform adequate legal research. Again, there's testimony in this record. Mr. Eisenberg gave conflicting testimony about who actually drafted this complaint, but I would suggest that if the court looks at this complaint, it's obviously a product of it's a hurried product, it's a rush product, just as the referee found. Finding number 4, Mr. Eisenberg had to know that Margaret was impecunious. We put the financial disclosure statements in the record. Testimony from Mr. Wilcox, the divorce attorney for Ms. Klein, about the fact that this was essentially a no-asset divorce. Ms. Klein was not even working at the time. I think he described her as having some experience in training horses and working on a farm. Finding number 5, that Mr. Eisenberg hoped to confront Margaret, and when she did not appear, he confronted her attorney in a rude and intimidating manner.
Well, if we agree with your conclusion that the findings of fact can't be overturned unless clearly erroneous, if we accept those findings, are we obligated to accept the legal conclusion that he violated the Supreme Court rule as the referee concluded?
I believe so, and let me explain why. I think there's a transitional finding that, again, the court is required to defer to the referee on, and that is the factual inference of Mr. Eisenberg's knowledge and intent in commencing this action. Those were the findings of Judge Graham in the civil case, albeit to a lower burden of proof. That was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. Petition for review was denied. Similar again to the Wadooley case. There was discussion in the Wadooley case and in the Lauer case about preclusion and whether a party could relitigate the issue of frivolousness in the context of the disciplinary proceeding. The referee here really did not rely on preclusion. He didn't mention it in his report. But I believe that if there is evidence in this record, any evidence, any credible evidence in this record to sustain the referee's fact inference of knowledge and intent on the part of Mr. Eisenberg, then the court is required to accept the inference drawn by the trial court as the trier of fact, the referee, and if so, that leads to the conclusion that the disciplinary rule was violated. There was testimony from Mr. Wilcox about the confrontation in the hallway. I think it's very clear from that testimony that Mr. Eisenberg did expect to encounter Ms. Klein on that date and physically hand her the lawsuit, personally serve the summons and complaint on her, and it's reasonable to conclude that that was part of an effort to harass and intimidate a woman who the referee saw in person and observed to be weak and vulnerable, just as Judge Koshnick testified. Statements made by Mr. Eisenberg to the Family Court Commissioner, in which Mr. Eisenberg characterized Margaret as a liar and a perjurer, which became essentially a mantra in the case. The referee concluded that the use of such demeaning phraseology and language was intended to harass and intimidate Ms. Klein, and there was testimony from Mr. Wilcox as to the impact that those words had on the client. There was testimony from Mr. Kreck, counsel for Ms. Klein in the civil case, about how she felt so humiliated by those words later appearing in the newspaper that she could barely come out of her house. Number 7, the Eisenberg account of an alleged jury reaction was a fabrication by Eisenberg of an event that never occurred. And this is tied to the liar and the perjurer comments. Mr. Eisenberg first told the story the day after the criminal trial about a juror or jurors, and that the story was inconsistent. Originally, it was a juror singular. That's what appears in Mr. Wilcox's notes. It's a juror singular when he tells the story to Judge Hugh at the motion hearing in July of 2001. Later on, the story evolves into maybe it was more than one juror, maybe it was two jurors. The story itself was framed in such a way that it could hardly be verified one way or the other. The referee found that this story was a fabrication. It was unbelievable. The referee found that Mr. Eisenberg lacked credibility. I think it's a reasonable inference for the referee to draw that when Mr. Eisenberg would make up this kind of story to justify calling Ms. Klein a liar and a perjurer, that he did so intending as part of this lawsuit to harass and maliciously injure her. Finding number 8, he contacted the local newspaper, not the district attorney, for the purpose of publicizing the civil case and repeating the false story about jurors storming Judge Koshnick's chambers and demanding that she be charged with perjury. I think it was reasonable for the referee to conclude that that type of conduct, going to the media with this story, this false story about jurors storming the chambers of the trial judge, which the trial judge said never happened, and which he was outraged about, was also part of a campaign to use this litigation to harass and maliciously injure Ms. Klein. Finding number 9 relates to repeating that story again before Judge Hugh at the motion hearing of July 23. There's reference to the telephone call to Mr. Kreck on July 23 about leverage. I would suggest that the referee was justified in drawing an inference of knowledge and intent from that call, because the use of a non-meritorious lawsuit to harass and intimidate somebody into surrendering some right in a divorce case is certainly an inappropriate use, and it's still harassment. It's using the lawsuit as a tool or a weapon, which is what we would suggest the record here supports. The witness list. We've summarized this in the facts section of our brief, but in a nutshell, Mr. Eisenberg filed a witness list in the civil case. Mr. Kreck testified that he conducted depositions of the people on the witness list because the words complained of weren't alleged in the complaint. He wanted to find out what the alleged defamation was. He finally arranged, after some hardship, which he described, to get the depositions of the people on the witness list. What did he find out from the people on the witness list? They didn't know anything about defamatory words. They had never spoken with Mr. Eisenberg. They had no idea why they were on the witness list, and they had no idea what they were supposed to know that would make them witnesses in the case. Again, this is further evidence of the rush to file this complaint, of the inadequate investigation that the referee had already alluded to. Finding number 12, the pattern of delay, the request for an adjournment, the non-appearance, and the sanctions by Judge Hugh. Exhibit 25 in the record is the decision by Judge Hugh in which Mr. Eisenberg and his client, and it was really Mr. Eisenberg's client, that took the brunt of sanctions based upon Mr. Eisenberg's conduct in the case. Judge Hugh detailed findings in support of those sanctions, and those sanctions were eventually reduced to judgment against Mr. Eisenberg's client based on the court awarding a default on Ms. Klein's counterclaim for spousal abuse, thereby making this case in some respects somewhat similar to the O.J. Simpson case and the subsequent civil litigation where you had a criminal acquittal followed by a civil action in which the acquitted defendant was found civilly liable for wrongful death.
Could I ask a clarifying question? Did Margaret make any false representations or statements to the police that caused William to be arrested and prosecuted?
Her testimony on the stand in this case was that she did not. There was testimony from Judge Koshnick, and again, this was on cross-examination, in which, and I believe it's at pages 213 and on in the transcript, where Judge Koshnick was asked, well, by Mr. Eisenberg, didn't she lie on the witness stand? Didn't she admit she lied to the police? Judge Koshnick's response was, she was a weak witness, she was a weak woman, she was intimidated on the witness stand. She reacted like many alleged victims of spousal abuse react, and basically there came a point where she was willing to say yes to anything in order to get off the witness stand. As Judge Koshnick recalled it, she never admitted precisely that she lied, but she may have made some statements that sounded something like that as part of an effort basically to end the cross-examination and get off the witness stand.
So your position would be that Margaret never made any false representations that caused William to be arrested?
Yes, and there's no record of it in this that she did in this case either, because the allegedly defamatory words are never pleaded in the complaint, and the criminal transcript was never produced in this case. I believe it's reasonable for the referee to draw the inference that the pattern of conduct here was part of an effort to use this lawsuit for purposes of harassment. This lawsuit was torture to Ms. Klein, being subpoenaed to testify by Mr. Eisenberg was torture to Ms. Klein, as recounted by the referee who personally observed her in the room. The longer this lawsuit went on, the more painful it was to her. I believe it's reasonable for the court, A, to have concluded that there was a deliberate pattern to delay this lawsuit. We've got those facts recounted in our brief. In fact, the mediation for which Mr. Eisenberg didn't appear for no reasonable excuse, as Judge Hugh found, was in fact mediation he had requested over the objection of Mr. Crack, who on behalf of his client simply wanted to get this case to trial and get it over with to relieve the agony that it was putting his client to be subject to this lawsuit.
Counsel, what are the cases that provide us the goalposts that we should be assessing the level of discipline between?
The level of discipline, I don't know that there is a comparable one, because I don't know that there is another attorney who has quite the disciplinary record of...
Sure. And often there isn't something that is exact, and so you take something that's comparable and talk about the mitigating or the aggravating circumstances in this case and come within a range.
I think I would suggest the Waduli case is really the closest to it, with the exception the Waduli case didn't have the same past discipline record of Mr. Eisenberg, but certainly the conduct of Attorney Waduli in bringing frivolous litigation, I think, is comparable here. And in that case, if I'm recalling it correctly, the recommendation was 90 days, and this court chose to make it 6 months.
That's right.
I think for the reasons that OLR is recommending at least 6 months here.
Well, also, if I recall, in that case, there was a rather large amount of money that had not been paid. In other words, the referee recommended 90 days, but one of the aggravating factors, could be wrong, was something over $100,000 that had been assessed and as a sanction that had not been paid, and the court was concerned about that. It's my recollection.
The sanction in Waduli, as I recall it, Your Honor, was $150,000, except there it was 50-50 as between the attorney and the client. Here it was 90-10, reflecting a finding by Judge Hugh that the primary responsibility fell on the attorney, Mr. Eisenberg.
So Waduli was 6 months with at least one aggravating factor that he didn't pay the money. And there may have been others, I can't remember, that caused the court to go from 3 months to 6 months. What other case gives us a ballpark range?
That's really the one that I focused on, Your Honor. I don't have others right offhand that I can refer to.
Well,
really, because there have been very few cases that have been brought to this level regarding frivolous litigation.
Lauer.
Well, then, Lauer case was a public reprimand, if I'm recalling correctly.
That was my question to you about that. What case, I mean, you deal with Waduli and Lauer on 17 and 18 of your briefs. If I remember, you have a footnote that indicates that the frivolous action was not the only charge in the case. Do you have a case where the only charge is bringing a frivolous action?
The only charge?
Charge.
I don't.
I think had four charges, and they found. I think they found all four.
The Waduli case did have some other factors involved in it, but I think the frivolousness was really the driving factor in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there were other factors that took Waduli from 3 months to 6 months, what would take, I would submit, Your Honors, that absent Mr. Eisenberg's past disciplinary history, this would probably be a public reprimand case. And it's really the past disciplinary history.
Would you even bring it if a warrant for his record?
Yes.
You would have brought it?
Yes.
You think Delaware would have brought it?
Yes. It would have been a public reprimand case, but for the prior discipline. My time is up.
Mr. Eisenberg.
Mr. Prosser has a question.
Mr. Eisenberg was reinstated in 2007. Is there any part of this case after his reinstatement?
I believe at or about the time of the reinstatement was when Mr. Eisenberg was pursuing appellate relief after the remand of the first appeal. And there may have been a petition for review pending with respect to his appeal from judgment entered after remand. That would have been the only part of it. Ultimately, I believe the sanction was ultimately paid in this case, and Mr. Eisenberg or Mr. Kao can correct me if I'm wrong on the date, but I believe it may have been paid in September of 2007 after this court denied the petition for review on the appeal after remand. The rest of it would have been before. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kao.
There's a reason the OLR fought hard to bootstrap the civil findings. And there's a reason why the OLR wants badly for you not to look behind the referee's decision and to accept without criticism his findings of fact. Because doing so, you won't find any basis for either the civil finding or the disciplinary charge. The answer to the Chief Justice's question is this would not have been brought by the OLR against any other lawyer in this state. There are pleadings filed in this state every day. I would submit in every county of this state, no less infirm, even if you think these are infirm, no less infirm than this. And they don't result in findings of frivolousness, and they don't result in a lawyer being up here being made to answer for charges of this kind. And there is no case. It's not coincidental that Mr. Schwarzenbach can't identify a case where coordinate with this sanction recommendation, there is no case where any discipline even remotely like this has been resulted from a single count of frivolousness. And it's dismaying that the OLR equivocates now on its recommendation. It filed a two-count complaint, and it didn't say it wanted at least 6 months. It asked for a six-month suspension. It filed a trial brief in this case, which is a part of this record, and it asked not for at least a six-month suspension. It asked for 6 months. One of the two counts is not even before us. It's been dismissed, and notwithstanding, I mean, it would be, I think, a little cheeky to be asking even for the 6 months, suggesting that the other charge, which is now dismissed and not before you, had no gravity in terms of the sanction recommendation. And perhaps it wasn't even. OLR talks about the credibility and Mr. Ninneman preoccupies himself in his report with the impairment of Mr. Eisenberg's credibility. That does not substitute for evidence of frivolousness in the institution of that lawsuit. Neither does not appearing at the mediation. I mean, if we want to use the disciplinary rules as a means of punishing people who we don't like or who we think we're angry or rankled by, then we're using this not as a principle, but as a bully's club. And incidentally, you know, it's to say simply that this was being used as a weapon or it's being made to injure someone. Well, I mean, if I sue someone for $1 million, I'm certainly trying to, it certainly is going to have the effect of injuring them. And the fact that they may trouble them or that they may cry is part of the process. The question isn't whether or not it causes injury or it's intended. If the question is it based on a valid set of claims? Is it properly motivated? There's nothing that's been in this record suggesting an improper motivation. Mr. Eisenberg didn't have anything to gain from this. He didn't bear this lady a grudge. Judge Graham didn't refer this for prosecution. Neither did Judge Koshner, who testified that she cried during the criminal trial, as she did during the civil proceedings. And that's certainly not something to be sought for. But it doesn't turn the allegations made in the lawsuit into frivolous allegations or the institution of the lawsuit a disciplinable offense. Mr. Eisenberg did indeed on occasion refer to this lady as a liar, and I'm sure it caused her great grief. It did, as do so many things in our adversary system. Mr. Deutsch was falsely accused of being a wife batterer, a felon. Not just someone who told a lie. The question isn't whether or not that's harmful. Of course it was
liar,
harmful.
Liar and a perjurer, wasn't it, Mr. Kale?
Yes, sir.
Had she ever been adjudicated a perjury?
No. No, she wasn't. But it was Mr. Eisenberg's firm belief, and that's critical here, whether or not he believed that she was perjuring herself during the course of that trial. And there was no question about what the words were. I mean, we knew that she had uttered words to the police that gave rise to the charges. Her statements were, I mean, she testified at the trial, and the statements she made to the police were reflected embodied in the criminal complaint.
So right. And his client had testified he had pushed her to the ground but had not hit her in the underlying trial.
I don't remember the exact words, but there was testimony about a physical encounter, but she was acquitted by a jury of the charges that she brought, and they were based exclusively on what she said.
Well, they're charges the state brought based on what she said. She doesn't bring the charges the state brought.
Yes. But we know what she said. I mean, we know that she accused him, and the jury didn't believe that she told the truth, because it couldn't have. And you know, it's interesting that the judge...
She couldn't have? What do you mean? She couldn't have told the truth. What do you mean by that?
The jury believed that she didn't tell the truth in her testimony, claiming that he had battered her, as the criminal complaint alleged, because they found him not guilty. I mean, unless they danced on the burden of proof, I think it's fair to assume that they believed she lied, as did Mr. Eisenberg.
But if she had been pushed to the ground, they might not have considered that battery. What is it that the state alleged based on her complaint that William did that is supposedly just was not true?
A much more violent set of actions. I'd be hesitant to describe them with particularity, but she alleged being struck and actions that were not just a matter of degree. It wasn't that she alleged having been pushed down and
it had to be more than simple battery if it was a felony.
I believe so. It was she alleged a series.
Endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon, or substantial battery, or...
I'm not able to say that.
You're going to consult with Mr. Eisenberg, are you?
May I?
Yes, may. But the red light's on, and we just have a few minutes, please.
Mrs. Klein alleged that Mr. Deutsch held her by the throat, held her by the throat over his head, using an impaired arm.
What were the charges? What were the charges the state brought? Are they in the record?
Yeah, they are. Second degree endangering safety, I'm being told by Mr. Eisenberg. I don't believe the transcript of the criminal trial or the criminal complaint is a part of this record.
I think in one of the briefs or one of the arguments, one of the findings, someone referenced cross-examination. She said he had a knife and that maybe he was just cutting with the knife and that he used it in conversation rather than actually threatening her with it, which is why I asked what the actual charges were. But I don't know for sure that that's what
Bear in mind, I mean, the questions that are being asked, aren't the evidence that this the assertion of this claim was not frivolous? I mean, Mr. Eisenberg, you know, tried this case. He was acquainted with it. Even if he was wrong, I mean, even if, in fact, you know, she was telling the truth and the jury was wrong, he certainly had a basis for making these allegations. William suffered on account of these allegations and was polygraphed, as Mr. Eisenberg points out.
Mr. Cale?
It should, as Mr. Eisenberg requested.
Pardon me?
Thank you, sir. This case should be thrown out, just as Mr. Eisenberg requested. That's what justice requires.
Thank you, Mr. Cale. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Schwarzenbach, for your arguments and for all these difficult cases for us on lawyer discipline. That ends our hearing on 07 AP 1083. Office of Lawyer Regulations versus Alan D. Eisenberg. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:25 in closed conference. We are in recess until our next day of